Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 4. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to CDPR's latest podcast episode on Let's Talk Development. My name is Sabah Shahid, and today's episode is about Pakistan's Skill Development Fund. I'd like to begin by introducing myself and then our guest as well for today. I am a development economist. I have experience in sustainable development, project management, developing training for local-led solutions. And I have an interest in sustainable project design as well. Our guest today is Ahmed Khan. Ahmed is one of the pioneers of e-commerce in Pakistan, with over two decades of experience leading and advising businesses in tech, logistics, and public sectors. He's currently the CEO of Punjab Skills Development Fund, Pakistan's largest skills development organization. Okay, so a little briefly about PSDF. It's been running since the past 10 years, training over 500,000 youths in 250-plus demand-driven trades through an ecosystem of 500-plus training service providers, primarily from the industry and private sectors. So, Ahmed, let's begin. First of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin a little with an understanding of your personal journey, because I think there's a lesson there to be learned for our larger audience. Your experience as an entrepreneur, you know, very successfully founding Chite and also Swift Logistics, and then your transition into the development sector. What drew you to skills development? And maybe if there were lessons you were able to translate across the two sectors.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure. So as my sort of, professional journey took shape, I sort of, passed some distinct sort of benchmarks and milestones in it. So the first part was all about, working at a big multinational and learning from, the best practices and how they work. Then sort of it was a transition into entrepreneurship and, family-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. And then, went back into consulting and, again, sort of, more in the learning phase. And then was the fun part where, started founding tech businesses. At the time, there was no concept of a tech startup in Pakistan. So, we sort of did that. My motivation for that was always sort of a reverse brain drain. I always felt that the best talent in Pakistan goes abroad. Mm-hmm. And that's because we have no ecosystem and we have no environment and infrastructure to support those people. So, the idea of doing tech startups was to, create a platform where people would be, the best people would be willing to stay, and those who are abroad, they have some place to come back to. From that, I went back into consulting, and consulting was again interesting. I wanted to sort of look at the intersection between digital and public sector, so sort of again more in a learning phase. And after that, I was like, okay, done a lot of exciting stuff, built businesses, grew businesses, started them from scratch, took existing ones and, did turnarounds. So now the idea was, KG, how can we now sort of give back and build another sort of, chain of youth that can now partake in sort of the growth of the economy? I've always sort of, my biggest pet peeve about Pakistan is sort of wasted talent and wasted resources. So the idea is, KG, if I look at it from a more numbers point of view, we have, very few people who are engaged in formal education. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the people who are engaged in formal education, most of them are at the primary level. So the dropout rate between primary and sort of, when I say primary, I mean kindergarten and that, right? Mm-hmm. Right up to, university education, your tertiary mm-hmm. education, jisko aap kehte hain. Uske andar, if you look at the sort of transition, if you have 20 million at the, at the kindergarten level, you have maybe a few hundred thousand who graduate university. So that dropout rate is phenomenal. So where do those people go? Mm-hmm. They obviously need some level of skills to be income earners. And then even those who are graduating, right, the sort of quality level outside the top few universities is sort of really low, right? So again, it comes, either they end up working for the government or they end up, through some references or, do that. And very few go into entrepreneurship. And then even those who finally do end up having some quality, there's no job market anymore, right? The economy is sort of not doing as well as it was, right, which means that there's no opportunity for them. So right now, the thesis was, KG, there's this huge drop-off of youth. Like, if you look at numbers, like I said, there's less than 20 million who are educated, who are in the formal education, and less than 1 million who are actually in the TVET sector. So where is the 100 million people going to go?
Right.
So the idea is, what can we do to facilitate that and turn them into sort of productive members of society?
I think you touched upon some very relevant aspects in terms of the labor market at large and our economy, right, and how it's structured. And you use the word traditional education. So what we see, of course, are various levels of inequality that our traditional education is sort of facilitating instead of correcting. So you have inequality in terms of people doing A-levels, people doing matriculation, and then all the number of individuals dropping out and also not receiving formal education. So ek to within Pakistani economy inequality inducing traditional education. And then also when you look at how Pakistan's integrated into the global economy, you have a huge proportion of our youth that is not participating in that, right? So ek international level pe bhi you have laggards when it comes to how they're participating in the global economy. So if we come towards the work PSDF is doing in terms of sort of filling that gap and providing that those extra skills that you so you don't necessarily need formal education, but you can still participate. So could you comment a little bit, about how they how you're narrowing that gap and sort of giving a chance to that sort of segment of society that isn't going through the traditional route?
Sure. So a couple of things there, right? First of all, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out what are the skills that are required at the international level. So if I step back a little, the focus of the government, as well as government institutions and as well as, you know, PSDF specifically, is to look at the export market. Right, one of the biggest problems in our economy is our foreign exchange and, you know, sort of our balance of payments, as we call it. Right, so what we need is we need more businesses that are export focused, and more people who are export focused. But we also have a lot of people that, you know, we can export manpower as well. So if you look at our programs from this year and our programs for next year, the entire focus is on the export industry and not just the traditional export industries, which are textile and agriculture and you know, chemicals and that. It is more on IT. It is more on, you know, services like caregivers. It is more on, you know, freelancing. It's there's that part. But there's also a huge focus on all the people we send abroad, which are, you know, in the millions.
Right.
We want to send more skilled workers. So now the idea is, we've identified the trades, we've identified the sort of skills that we need. And next year, you're going to see a huge shift, at least from the Punjab government's point of view, where we are going to train people who can actually be employed abroad at skill levels, like not unskilled workers. So that's sort of, you know, the way the narrative and the way the focus and strategy is focused now going forward.
And do you think also from the demand side, so people demanding these skills, is there a shift in perception as well? Because traditionally, though, you will see a lot of Pakistani families saying you need that degree, you need that sort of diploma at least. Is there a shift in demand as well? Because TEFTA especially doesn't have the best sort of track record when it comes to people saying, "Acha, this is... an area that's really supporting the kind of skills deficit that we need."
So, you know, the thing that was different and the thing that was missing was sort of the last step. Traditionally, governments have been completely focused on input metrics or input KPIs, right? How many people have you trained? In what skills have you trained them? Now the focus is completely on outcome, right? So when I sit and talk to my team, or, you know, when I sit and talk to my leadership or my board, the idea is, what are we going to do to change outcomes? And outcomes are very simple: change in income, right? So, and what do we need to do to bring that, right? One, we need industry linkages, right? So we can't just train people and then hope and pray, okay, oh, you know, our training is so good, somebody will come and pick them up. We need sort of that linkage beforehand. Industry needs to get involved at the curriculum design stage, at the assessment stage, mm-hmm. at the trade selection stage, mm-hmm. right? So there's that part. Then, once the industry gets involved, and similarly, it's the same for international placement as well. What we're doing there is we're actually bringing the demand first. So, what people like to call reverse engineering. So we bring the demand and then we train the people. So it has become so outcome focused now, mm-hmm. that that perception will have to change, right? So with industry linkage, with academia linkage, and with job placement, mm-hmm. is I think was sort of where we stopped in previous years, but now going forward, this is going to change.
Sure, and I think it'll be interesting to know if you could go a little bit more into detail on the pedagogy of it, right? So, aapka process kya hai? How do you set up the curriculum? How is it designed? Is there, for instance, a training of trainers? What does that process look like? And how is it different from what has been done historically?
So, the focus is, again, once you do demand-driven trades, mm-hmm. or output-driven, when you have outcome-driven design, the way it works is that first of all, we're trying to digitize a lot of our training, right? Mm-hmm. So we're coming up with hybrid models. Mm-hmm. We've come up with the skills camp nomenclature that we're using, sure. which is going to train multiples of students for the same price, right? And that's a hybrid between digitizing the content in the curriculum, mm-hmm. and adding flexibility in the practical aspect. If you want to go to a workshop or you want to go code, you need a lab, so that part is going to be flexible. So apart from that, what we're doing is KG, because it's reverse engineered, we're saying, okay, this is the job that is available. What are the skills that are required? What is the assessment or qualification or certification that is going to be acceptable to mm-hmm. that employer? And to get that certification, what does the curriculum need to look like, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of it is industry driven. A lot of it is we're using best practices globally, mm-hmm. and we're trying to, so if you want to get into the details, the curriculum is either set by an institute or an organization called NAVTEC, which is okay. a federal body, or TEVTA, or similar Punjab government bodies. Mm-hmm. The assessment is again being done by Punjab government bodies. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to introduce more international certifications. Okay. We're trying to come up with our own certifications. We're trying to develop our own curriculum, which is, like the Punjab Textbook Board and the other mm-hmm. Curriculum development agencies, it's a bit dated.
Right.
So we're now trying to revamp this. And the good thing is that everything is available online. So we're partnering with Philippines, we're partnering with Indonesia, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, because they mm-hmm. also have they're doing a lot of good work. And even in Latin America, countries like Venezuela and Brazil are doing a lot of good work. So we're sort of partnering with them to exchange curriculum. We're partnering with them to exchange sort of trade craft, teaching methodologies. So the good thing about PSDF is we don't own any infrastructure. We work exclusively with the ecosystem. So what we do is we go to the ecosystem, which is a private training hub places, and we tell them that, look, you want to work with us? This is the certification you need. This is the level of trainers you need. We will pay for it, theek hai? And we'll make sure that it's in your best interest to do it. But you go and find and build these resources. So because of our low infrastructure and asset-light model, mm-hmm. we can really shape the ecosystem. And once we funded it for a little while, then they sort of become independent and self-sustainable. Then if that training has value and we can actually provide jobs, then people will be willing to pay for it as well. So we sort of do the pilot for the first year or 2 years.
Sure.
And then if it's good enough, like any good capitalist system, it'll self-sustain.
So can you talk a little bit about the demographics of the students that you have? So what are they like? And are there any sort of patterns that have shifted over time? So traditionally, kis kisam ke students aa rahe the, and now with this new model and the kind of sort of messaging you're doing, do you see a different audience? And also, what is the split across genders or geographies within Punjab?
So the change actually happens by design, right? It's okay. not, quite honestly, I don't like leaving things to chance and seeing what comes up, right?
Sure.
So our programs are designed to attract a certain type of demographic. Mm-hmm. So we want sort of the higher level people. Mm-hmm. we are mandated to do 40% females, right?
Sure.
That's sort of a hard mandate, and we don't try to we definitely don't compromise on that. We are trying to introduce 5-10% of minorities or marginalized communities. Sure. We're doing exclusive programs for transgenders this year, right? So nobody's ever bothered about that sector of society or segment of society. And now, so, you know, we are training 2,200 transgenders, and we're going to make sure that, you know, they are able to get off the streets and into what we call dignified income. We are, you know, we're doing a program for rural women. These women are educated. They are in villages, not even peri-urban, like actual villages, and have no source of income, or have, they don't even have a method of earning money. The only thing they can do is become school teachers at the local primary school or secondary school. So we are trying to teach them on how to generate income, you know, become self-employed, become freelancers, do, and it's mostly in digital. So keeping that, you know, keeping the design in view, we are now attracting or trying to attract people, one, like I said, who are very marginalized. Women focus is always there. We call it poor and vulnerable as well. And then we're trying to attract this high level, high tech sort of thing. Because next year we're going to do programs on international placement. We're going to do a program for the BPO sector. And we're going to do a program for high tech IT skills. So again, we can easily turn this around, and you know, the next program might be for out of school children.
Okay.
The next program might be for, you know, sustainable education, like you know, green agriculture or EVs. So again, this is a design, and you know, and obviously it keeps changing. You know, we'll do one segment, and then, you know, we don't want to leave anyone behind.
Right.
So then we'll do the next one.
Right. You spoke a bit about the industry matching as well, right? So ensuring that aapka curriculum is actually addressing the needs of the market. So what are some of the industries, like you mentioned textile traditionally hai, export-led. What are some other industries that you're looking at where you see that, you know, people or your students are really interested that, okay, this is a skill I want to learn because I have that so-and-so job in mind?
So textile is always going to be the biggest sector. Agriculture is always going to be a huge sector, right? So hard to get away from that. But what we've seen is, you know, as sort of this Gen Z, Gen Alpha sort of come into play, they are more interested in services. So, you know, they want to be nurses, they want to be caregivers, they want to go into hospitality, or they want to go into retail. So we're also looking at, you know, things like I said, like EV, people want to do digital, they want to learn content creation. Call it what you want, but you know, TikTok is huge, right? So they want to learn how to become TikTok influencers. So things like that are becoming more and more popular. But sort of, you know, the focus again is very, you know, we're a little laser focused on anything that we can export, whether it's a service or whether it's a person. So, you know, wherever we can go with that.
Sure. I want to go back to something we discussed earlier on, which was the inequality, right? So you do have this segment that's marginalized, that's not going through formal education. Perhaps even employers are looking for that sort of check mark, ya wo thappa ki aapke paas degree hai. But what the work PSDF is doing is, of course, trying to challenge that status quo. Do you see a link with the human development sort of index in the work you're doing, and that translating into, for instance, not only incomes, but also in terms of their livelihoods, right? Because we have South Asia, maybe one of the lowest HDIs. I think it's less than 0.6, 0.5 something, 0.54. And I was just looking at the numbers, you know, so if we compare ourselves to Sri Lanka, it's almost 0.8. So what's the linkage there?
So look, again, when PSDF was set up, you know, in our mandate or in our official charter, it's written that, you know, we are going to focus on the poor and vulnerable, so which is the bottom of the bottom of society. And we have done that, and we will continue to do that. These are the people who literally, you know, no one looks at. And it's also, it's very hard to reach them. It's very hard to mobilize them, and it's very hard to convince them to come to you, right? So, you know, we give stipends, we give transport allowances, we take trainings to them, right? Because literally these people have no concept of the benefit. They don't even know you know, what, how useful it will be, or how their lives will change. Mm-hmm. So, and then if you're able to convince the individual, then the family is like, nahin, you know, mara bacha theek hai ji, wo the mistri ban raha hai, he's working with the local electrician, whatever, right? So we will always look at that segment. Right. We're trying to do other things as well, but this segment is always going to be at the core of everything that we do. And you know, if we look at our history and if we look at our achievements, so traditionally, you know, the reported numbers that we've seen are between 60 and 70% of every people that we train have reported jumps in income. And now what we're trying to focus on is entrepreneurship as well. So again, you know, the numbers say that every entrepreneur, you know, sort of has employs about on average 4 people and then has about 12 people who are directly affected as suppliers, as consumers and whatever, right? So because of that, you know, and we do, all our reporting is done by a third party, right? So we'll hire, you know, sort of the best people to independently evaluate our outcomes. And you know, I'm very happy and you're very proud of the work that, you know, the team has done, that that we always report a very high sort of change in income. And that's how we measure it, right? Recently, you know, we started measuring happiness and you know, sort of upward social mobility in terms of, you know, just how they feel, their lifestyle, their sort of family structure, have they been able to educate their kids and things like that, right? So all in all, honestly, if you transition someone to income, you will see all the positive outcomes, right? You don't even need to worry about everything else. If you just stop at training people, then, you know, then you're going to see frustration. You're going to see, oh, this is wasted. And these people are going to keep wanting to come back and keep going through trainings, because that's when they make money and they get stipends, right? And they stay occupied. So you have to make that last link with either industry or move them to self-employment. Otherwise, you know, you're going to lose all the momentum and all the effort that you've done.
Sure. I'm going to, you mentioned entrepreneurship and PSDF's focus on building those sort of entrepreneurial skills as well. And in our introduction, we spoke about sort of your experience, you know, with the tech startups. I also currently work at work with startups at the Center for Entrepreneurship here at LUMS. So I'm curious to hear your take on this, because entrepreneurship will look very differently for a different person, for a different type of people, right? So you will have someone going through the formal education, has enough saving, has, you know, an angel investor at hand, chahe wo family ka koi banda ho, and is ready to take that leap because sort of they have that financial cushion. But what I see is they're also the most scared. They want to make sure, you know, everything is in place. Will their idea work? You know, they're still perhaps working their day job, coming to the center in the evening. Wo complete sort of commitment nahi hai. I'm curious, so the kind of community you work with, who perhaps doesn't have those guardrails about them, they're probably, I mean, I don't want to sort of put words in your mouth, but is there a more sort of drive because that's all they have? And do you see the nature of their innovation or entrepreneurial capacity sort of really sort of jumpstart or kickstart because of these trainings? Is there a measurable or sort of observable difference?
It's kind of, as in, to be honest, we've never measured it, but you know, anecdotally or you know, what we've observed through different reports, because we keep doing this stuff, right? We do a lot of research. We work with academia, sociology professors, and you know, sort of more pol sci, social science majors who want to come in and, you know, just sort of do more of the behavioral stuff and more of the well-being stuff. So what we've seen is, one, that that when they go to entrepreneur, they're definitely a lot more desperate, right? And there's a lot more at stake. The ideas are also sort of less super innovative. They're more like, acha, let's get a Nadra franchise, or let's open a small shop where, you know, we can sell Jazz top up, or or, you know, Telenor top up, things like that. Or, you know, let's open a small Kriyana store and things like that, right? So the risk appetite is a little low.
Okay.
Desperation is definitely a little high, but the drive is there, right? Okay. So what we've seen is, and the success rate the success ratio is much higher than tech startups.
Right.
Because, you know, they yeah. literally have no fail-safe, and it's their own money, or, you know, it's money borrowed at you know, sort of almost scary conditions and terms, right? So the way it's structured is that their entrepreneurship is you know, obviously going to be at a lower scale, but it's the chances of success are a lot higher. They do things which are very localized, which are very personal, which have a... This was a very interesting sort of observation. They have a customer base built in, right? Which is either their community, their neighborhood, mahalla, jaise hum kehte hain, ya baradri. So, you know, so they usually start their businesses with that and see how it grows.
Sure.
So it's very interesting. The captive audience or the captive customer or the support mechanism is less in setting up the business, but more in making sure the business is successful, which is very counterintuitive to how we... you know, we did tech startups where all the support came in, you know, in terms of money and setting up the business, and you know, sort of they weren't necessarily customers or they weren't necessarily buying, but they were helping you set it up. In these communities, it's very interesting that, you know, the support comes in actually, you know, growing revenue rather than you know, the capex or the you know, startup capital.
And what do you think with that transition from going from sort of a very safe idea to something that could be more groundbreaking? So we're not necessarily saying we're creating a unicorn here, but through maybe the skills that they're receiving or the networking they're getting to do with industry, what are some other sort of elements that can go in, ingredients that can go in, so we see thori si transition to more sort of mature ideas?
So what we've started doing is, and you know, we're doing it especially in our digital women training program, is we're introducing them to mentors, right?
Okay.
So we've introduced a module that we call product selection. So the product selection module is them working, you know, one-on-one or, you know, in small groups with mentors who are helping them in coming up with a business idea. Because one of the things that we've realized is that, you know, it's sort of the hardest part, right, in deciding what to sell or what to make. So we're hoping that experience, and again, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to do what the mentor is doing or go into the same industry that the mentor is involved in. But that sort of business person, which is usually a successful sort of female entrepreneur, is helping these young girls decide, okay, what is relevant in your context? So one really good idea came out that, you know, they said, oh, you know, in your village, why don't you do beekeeping and make honey? Another very interesting one was, you know, in your village, why don't you open up, you know, one of these Instaprint type shops, like, you know, you do wedding cards and, you know, things like that. So it's not groundbreaking, but for that geography and that income segment, it's very innovative. So what we felt is that, you know, just brainstorming and making an enabling environment is very conducive to idea development. And then, you know, the fear of, you know, okay, I don't even know the first step. Okay, I want to do beekeeping. What is the first thing you need to do? So then this mentor sort of helps them and says, oh, you know what? You need to buy bees.
Right.
And to buy bees, you need, you know, those hives that you know, where you need to breed them. So sort of, you know, that path is sort of handheld for them right at the beginning. And that's what, again, you know, we miss in a lot of our startups. Everyone thinks they know everything, but these people are sort of privileged in that sense, or lucky that they have people to handhold them and you know, and most importantly, to help them brainstorm. And, you know, sort of as counselors, you know, if things aren't going so well, or, you know, there's opposition from home or something goes wrong in your personal life. So, you know, you have somebody to talk to. So it's very interesting. And so far, you know, the early results are looking interesting.
I think you're absolutely correct. Your mentor's role hota hai, we often don't realize how important it is, especially in terms of making things more accessible. Because the fear, especially for women, I know is real, you know, like, because there's a lot to navigate in terms of just entering the employment market, even if it's self-employment, right? But there is one more thing I want to touch upon in terms of the work the fund is doing with respect to sort of digital learning, because that's also improving accessibility, right? And recently you've partnered with Coursera as well. So you pivot here towards more digital learning. If you could sort of talk about that and how that's impacted kind of skills development at large.
So again, you know, I guess just naturally navigate and gravitate towards digital because that's just, you know, who I am as a person as well. So the idea is to build an LMS where every training that we do, whether it's physical or whether it's online, we digitize that content and we make it available online. So you know the benefit of that, right? So we become sort of a Coursera or we become sort of a Khan Academy and you know that training becomes widely available. So that's one part. The other part is, KG, it reduces cost significantly and it increases scale significantly. Because, you know, in a physical classroom, it's hard to have more than 20, 25 people, you know, just because these are practical skills, right? But online, in self-paced learning, you can have hundreds and thousands, right? So that's very useful. So it's not just so... It's not just we're training people in more digital skills. So AI prompting is like, you know, it's just one of those simple things that everyone talks about. But for these people, it's alien language. Like it's like, you know, Aramaic or you know, sort of talking in some ancient script. But you know, we're teaching them. And obviously, this, so, but to do AI prompting, you need to first teach them English. So we're thinking, and but all of these things can be done online because, you know, these aren't, it's not like welding and it's not like, you know, making sort of an electric circuit. So because of the nature of what, so the nature of the training and the medium is very conducive to online learning. So because of that, we're seeing a much larger uptake and a reduction in our cost. But then we have to supplement that with mentors because there's no replacing the human touch and, you know, the personalized attention yet, right? We haven't reached that stage. You know, we've seen it in movies, but but right now I think learning is best done in you know, sort of more intimate and more sort of interactive ways.
So one more question before we move towards the concluding segments. So ye numbers kafi impressive hai. Over 650 individuals trained already, and you have like almost a nationwide network now.
650,000.
650,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and obviously you will be scaling. So how do you bring that balance? Obviously you want to cover as many people as you can, but you mentioned ek to you're bringing in mentors, but how do you ensure quality jo hai wo compromise na rahe while you're growing?
So that brings us to sort of our operating model, right? Okay. So what we do is we have an outcome-based approach. So payments are made to our training providers based on the outcomes, right? Okay. So that sort of takes care of the quality.
Sure.
So, you know, if the input is poor and so, and that starts with selection. So if you choose the wrong individual to train, you will never achieve an outcome. So they've become more sort of careful in who they choose and who they let enter into the program. They have to be actually driven. They're not coming for the free stipend because, you know, they know that their payment is linked to that. The other thing is they have to ensure that their training is of that higher quality that these people can actually learn something. And then people also have to ensure that the linkage to industry is there so that, you know, that transition, that final transition towards income is also there. So, you know, we sort of take care of it through that. And then obviously our efforts are there, right? That we have to make sure that, you know, we're actually participating in the process. Our design is good. Our observation is good. Our monitoring is good. Our operations are good. And at the end of the day, you know, the mentors are useful. So that sort of part. And then the other thing is, because we're going digital, if you just look at the sheer numbers, right? We have 240 million people in the country. Like we keep saying that, you know, 50% of those are under the age of 20 or whatever, 25, which means that, you know, you have 150 million people to train. Like 20 million, I say, are in the formal education. There's 100 million people who are outside the system, right? So 650,000 is nothing compared to 100 million people. So we've barely scratched the surface. We need a lot more of these programs. But more importantly, there is nowhere to put these people because their economy isn't there. So we can do whatever we can, you know, with the right funding, with the right sort of models. But until the economy sort of takes shape, we're going to be wasting a lot of this money. So right now we're at the right scale. You know, these people can set up businesses and you know, get jobs or even go abroad. But you know, if we want to increase the scale, we need a larger sort of think about where they're going to go. Where can our economy and can our sort of ecosystem sustain them? So that's sort of now the next level of thinking. So that's why we want to train entrepreneurs, because, mm-hmm. you know, then they can sort of stimulate this. And right. that's why we want to focus on export income, because that sort of then can mm-hmm. can sort of start that cycle sure. of you know, the economic, the real economic growth, as well as, you know, more employment.
I feel like there's a lot more I want to pick your brains about, but we're unfortunately limited by the kind of time we have. But before we end, you mentioned a little bit about where we are right now with respect to PSDF and how you see it growing in the future. But how do you really see it addressing the youth bulge? For instance, a lot of analysts will say, okay, your liability, you know, it's if you're not, like you said, it's, we've just scratched the surface. If you're not really meaningfully engaging the youth, so it can go both ways, right? So, Ekto, how is PSDF seeing the next 5 to 10 years in terms of how it's growing? And then also a message you have for the youth, okay, you know, how can they engage and perhaps so relook or rephrase their sort of approach to employment. It doesn't necessarily have to be traditional. Like you mentioned, you can be an entrepreneur and you're creating jobs.
So yeah, I guess the using sunscreen analogy isn't going to work. So look, we look at skills as three things, right? So you have sort of the non-cognitive or mm-hmm. behavioral skills, then you have problem-solving skills, and then you have technical skills. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to work with the education department, and we're trying to figure out, okay, how can we do this properly? Mm. So some skills can be taught at the primary sort of class 1 to 5 mm. level, right? Which are your behavioral skills. Kisi tameez se baat karni hai, stop at traffic lights, don't throw garbage, you know, be polite, be on time, you know, things like that. So that I feel like, you know, the formal education sort of needs to own part of that process. Then, you know, as they grow older, you know, they need some problem solving skills. They need to think about, okay, I need to fix a light bulb. Like, mm-hmm. how do I do that, mm-hmm. right? How do I think about mm-hmm. like, simple problems? And then I feel at some point you have to diverge the paths, right? So you have to, you know, take them out of the formal education system, because one, you don't have the infrastructure, and two, the outcomes are nowhere close to what we want them to be. That's going to take a huge mindset change. Mm-hmm. Because right now, no matter what segment of society you belong to, ji BA karana hai, ji MA karana hai, theek hai, then masters kar le bacha ya bachi, phir dekhenge, mm-hmm. right? So there's going to, you know, we need a lot of sort of brain shift and mindset change to bring that about. The youth bulge, honestly, is such a huge benefit if we can make it productive. Like, look at what China is doing, right? They converted their entire population into this productive behemoth of mm-hmm. a machine, right? Mm-hmm. So why can't we start doing that as well? The difference is that, you know, they need skills. I was listening to Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, and he said, you know, we're not going to China because it's cheap. We're going because nobody else has that skill. So if, and honestly, you have to teach the skill first before people will come. You can't invite industry into your market and then say, oh, you come and you train people. Mm-hmm. And then, so you have to invest in that first. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that the government is very, very focused on skill development. This year, a few months ago, they set up an entire ministry called the Skill Development and Entrepreneurship Ministry, right? So they are completely dedicated and focused, and you know, everyone now sees that with such a huge youth bulge, such, you know, rising population, we need to have a more vibrant sort of skill development or, you know, tech sector. So I think right now is the best time to look at this, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, so we have DevTA, we have PVTC, we have you know, we have a minister, sort of a chairman of our task force. So all the sort of chips are in place. Now, literally, it's on us to deliver on it, right? There's funding that has been made available. The programs are there. The design is there. And honestly, you know, if we don't get this right, then it's only our fault, right? We have no one else to blame.
So I think we'll conclude with one last message from you for the youth. So a lot of it you're saying is mimicking the economy, the pattern of the socioeconomic sort of aspects need to be in place. But within that context, how can a young person find motivation? How can they remain sort of driven to the idea that, you know, I can still contribute, still do something meaningful?
I think, you know, you said it right there, right? The idea that you know, the people I work with, the younger people, the single message is, guys, whatever you're doing, contribute. Mm-hmm. Contribute positively. Don't be a burden on the system, on your parents, because, you know, joint families have a lot of places to hide. Take care. You have, you know, 8 people in the house, 7 of them work. One person is just like, you know, I don't really need to work. I'll just do the housework. I'll go get the milk from the shop. I'll go get the bicycle or tire fixed, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? If you know, the water pump isn't working, I'll go get that fixed. So my sort of advice is, Kiji, contribute. And there are so many avenues to contribute. Learn something. Learning right now is so easy. You know, you have YouTube. All you need is internet. Even if you don't have internet, you know, you can literally, you know, just turn on the TV. And there's so many learning opportunities. Honestly, most of the information I get nowadays is either from Instagram or TikTok. Mm-hmm. So my sort of request to everyone is, okay, just keep learning and figure out how to use what you've learned to contribute something positive. Because if everyone becomes a positive contributor, you will see just the economy boom, you'll see society boom. And, you know, a lot of problems that, you know, socioeconomic problems that we have are because of poverty, right? So if we can sort of make everyone a positive income generator, hopefully, you know, a lot of the other stuff will take care of itself.
So I think that's a great note to end on. The onus is on us as individuals, taking that responsibility, ensuring we're giving back. So I think with that lesson, we'll thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And for the work that you're doing at PSDF. And all the best.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure.